Whiskey is big business. A huge understatement, I know, but whether bourbon or rye, Scottish, Irish, Japanese, or even Indian, discerning palates from around the world and insatiable thirst for new flavor profiles and exclusive malts has made many in the industry, from collectors to distillers, a lot of money. And in reality, the giants of the drinks industry globally have amassed much of the wealth, trading on prestige, myth, and old-fashioned marketing. It's an industry Louise McGuan knows very well. Louise is the founder of J.J. Corey, an Irish whiskey label she launched in 2015, after spending more than 20 years working on premium drinks brands. Louise would later join the global marketing team for Veuve Clicquot working in France, followed by Pernod Ricard in London, and then for drinks giant Diageo in Singapore. Eventually, Louise quit her job working on luxury labels and returned to Europe with her husband, where some research on local distilling in Ireland led her to uncover the history of J.J. Corey, a 19th century inventor and businessman from County Clare, where her family is from. He practiced what is called whiskey bonding, sourcing whiskey from third-party distillers and then maturing and blending the whiskey and releasing it under your own name. Bonding died out as the Irish whiskey industry was decimated in the 20th century. And with most new ventures capitalizing on the boom in craft distilling, Louise was sold on reviving the tradition of whiskey bonding, with a modern take on blending, branding, and growing a business. And so, from her parents' farm, the Chapelgate Whiskey Company was launched. In 2016, Louise bought a warehouse and filled it with her first casks, and started to work on the branding of J.J. Corey. Louise turned to crowdfunding to test interest first in the U.S. market and spent a few years working on her first release called The Gale, an award-winning blend which proved her model worked. She's since secured a multi-million pound funding round and released several more exclusive blends and, in fact, has no plans to distill her own spirits. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs on Monocle 24 with me, Daniel Bage. Here's Louise now to walk us through her personal journey and the story of her whiskey label, J.J. Corey.
I went to college in the UK and then sort of miraculously I ended up moving to the US immediately after college. And I moved to the US around about the time they invented this thing called the internet. And, you know, it was sort of booming and all of these bricks and mortar shops were going in, turning into clicks and mortar, as they called it at the time. And I actually went over to the US to go work in communications. And actually, I actually worked for a startup at the time writing content. And then that kind of morphed into me doing some PR and marketing for that particular startup. Did that for about 18 months. And then very quickly and very early on into my career, 18 months, in fact, I ended up getting picked up by Moët Hennessy, which is the drinks division of LVMH. And I ended up going to do marketing communications in the US for a brand called Champagne Veuve Clicquot, very well-known brand. And that's really kind of where I got my start. I was based out of New York, but I was traveling all over the United States doing marketing and communications and commercial campaigns. So it was a really good grounding on how certainly the luxury drinks world works, but also, you know, the sort of nitty gritty on the street part as well, sales and all that sort of stuff.
And was that world interesting to you beyond the marketing side of it, but the drinks industry and spirits, I imagine you got to learn as well?
Yeah, the lovely thing about luxury spirits and wine in particular is that product knowledge is vital to what you do. You know, it's more than a consumer brand if it's a luxury drink. It's not exactly mass produced, you know, like maybe a very, very lower end, cheaper spirit like a vodka might be. Anything that's kind of in that super premium luxury sector is going to have people behind it. You know, it's going to have people who are growing grapes. There's people picking the grapes. There's winemakers blending the wine together. And in the case of spirits, for example, it's the same situation. For a higher end kind of whiskey or any sort of spirit, there's going to be people in the background who have crafted that. It's not going to be made by a machine per se. So for the luxury end of the drinks industry, you absolutely have to know your stuff. So I was packed off at a very young age, and I was about 22, to go and learn everything there was to learn about fine wines and spirits. And that, as a social skill, to be frank with you, was tremendous. You know, I was the one that people, you know, passed the wine list to in my early 20s at restaurants and things like that. So it gave me a really good grounding and appreciation for those kind of products and the people behind them as well.
I imagine as a brand storyteller, there's just amazing access to people and these incredible brands that are in that portfolio. But where did you move on in your career from there? And when did you start thinking about maybe doing something on your own?
It took me a long time to get to the point where I was willing to take the leap. After working in New York, I was actually transferred to go and live in Champaign for a while and to work on like the global brand team and do a lot more sort of like strategic sort of marketing and commercial stuff. And then when you're in that kind of track, when you're on the global level in multinational drinks corporations in particular, particularly the big four or five, you get into that particular track quite early, and then they tend to want to move your skill set from country to country. And there's a lot of crossover between various different businesses. You know, after I left LVMH, I ended up going to work for another huge big French drinks company called Pernod Ricard out of London, and actually got into sort of higher end vodka with them at the time. And then after that, I went to another big multinational called Diageo, and I worked on their higher end portfolio. They were sort of building out a luxury portfolio at the time, and I ended up working for that. That then took me to Singapore, and I was based there for a while. And throughout all of that, it was probably about 60 to 80% travel, global travel going on during that time period. And it was nearly 20 years of that particular track, you know, that corporate track, going up the ladder and getting different sort of levels of experience and in different elements of the business as well. And the thing about that track is that I always kind of compare it, certainly my corporate days, they were wonderful and they equipped me to do what I'm doing right now. But you're either a corporate person or you're not. And in reality, I never was. I was always an entrepreneur. But when I grew up, I didn't know anybody who was an entrepreneur, most certainly. You know, the term startup didn't exist, quite frankly. You know, the concept of going off and doing something on my own was just not in my reality. It wasn't in my world. But throughout my career, everything I ever did, every big project I ever got, I ran it, if I look back on it, in a very entrepreneurial way. You know, I just took a project and I just blew it up as big as it could possibly be. And I brought teams around me to kind of make it happen. And I didn't make a lot of friends doing that, quite frankly, in corporations, because corporations don't want internal entrepreneurs. You know, they want people who have an entrepreneurial spirit, but who play the corporate game. So ultimately, I decided to leave after close to 20 years when I was based out in Singapore. And I was running this huge program for Diageo called World Class. It was this huge, big thing, search for the world's best bartender, massive commercial program and marketing program in about 50 countries. And it was fantastic. But I found myself sort of doing less and politicking more. And politicking inside corporate organizations for me is very boring. I don't want to do that. So I felt like it was time to do something new. And my husband was actually living in London. We had gotten married, but ended up living apart for 2 years. And I was living in Singapore, and something had to give, you know, something had to kind of go. So I looked around at the industry because I had access to what was going on in the industry, obviously working for a multinational. And I saw that Irish whiskey was on the rise quite significantly. And Ireland would be 15, 20 years behind the United States, certainly in most drinks trends. And I had watched very closely the craft distilling boom happen in the United States. And it was very interesting to see what was going on there and the kind of brands that were coming out. And I realized that the time was probably right, if I was going to do anything, was to capitalize on the growth of Irish whiskey, which is in double-digit growth globally for the last decade or so, and the rise of craft, what's termed, you know, craft or independent sort of drinks companies. And so I took the leap.
Give us a sense of what state the Irish whiskey industry was in when you decided to do something there, because in a sense, it has always been craft. These are small-scale distillers. There are a lot of big names as well in the blended world that we would know about, see on a bar shelf somewhere. But what state was the industry in?
The Irish whiskey industry has a very sorry kind of history, and it sort of mirrors the history of Ireland itself, quite frankly. Mm. So, you know, there's always a debate as to who invented whiskey. I don't know, Scottish, Irish, the Mayans, who knows? Like, somebody at some point invented it. And at one point, Ireland was much better known for it, certainly on a qualitative terms, than Scotland was. And we were the most widely distributed globally. And we were just known for, you know, Uisge Baha was Irish before it was sort of Scottish, really. And there were hundreds of distilleries around Ireland. It was all going very, very well. And then two things happened. Number one, the industry got a bit insular and they refused to adopt new technology. So this Irish guy, this Irish revenue officer, invented a thing called a coffee still, which is like a column still, which was a brand new piece of technology, which allows you to make whiskey faster and cleaner, right? And the powers that be in Irish whiskey at the time, this is like the 1800s, they rejected that piece of technology and the Scottish took it on. They decided to adopt it. So suddenly Scotland could outproduce us. And that was a problem because demand was growing quite significantly. Ireland was stuck using pot stills and they weren't really able to keep up with the demand that was coming through from the British Empire, quite frankly, and the United States, which was expanding. So we started to be outproduced and that was kind of our first problem, really. And then geopolitical circumstance took over, right? So we forgot, we didn't take on new technology. And then we had a famine. And then we had like this long drawn out war of independence. Then we had a trade war with the British Empire. And then there was prohibition in the United States. And over a 50-year period, the entire industry basically collapsed. And when I say collapsed, all the distilleries closed pretty much. And our production output went to almost nothing. Meanwhile, Scotland was producing to beat the band and they took all of our market share. And since about 1930, it's been like that, essentially. So if you fast forward to today, 2015, when I founded the business, that's honestly where we were. We had a monopoly producing whiskey in Ireland for an extended period of time. That turned into a duopoly. You know, two companies essentially made every single Irish whiskey brand you've ever heard of for 40 or 50 years. And then that was broken by a guy called John Teeling, who set up who converted like a medical alcohol factory into a whiskey production facility back in the 90s. And then kind of nothing happened. But then around about 2015, there was a lot of talk about how craft distilling was coming to Ireland. And that's all it was when I set up the business. The category was in significant double-digit growth, but it was just one big company driving that growth, one of my former employers, really. And we could all see that there was a thirst for this. You know, brown spirits are having a moment. It happens once every two generations or so, and people are moving away now from white spirits and they're coming into to brown spirits. And we're very well placed to take that market share, essentially. So very simply, to answer your original question, when I started, we were really coming out of 100 years of a duopoly on the island of Ireland and no variety in whiskey making, just a couple of big multinationals making it.
That's absolutely fascinating. An incredible history as well, and it sounding like a great opportunity as well for you to move into. I mean, many people around the world will know sort of the whiskey industry from Scotland or bourbon from the south in the United States or rye from where I'm from in Canada. But Irish whiskey, I mean, I guess a lot of people don't really know a lot about it other than the big distillers that we've mentioned. But tell me about specifically the style of production that you're doing, because this is something that I had never heard of, actually, called whiskey bonding. And what is that?
Yeah, so the reason you've never heard of it and the reason people don't know a lot about Irish whiskey is that, to be frank, the narrative has been very tightly controlled by one or two companies for a very long time. You know, that happens in any industry that's controlled by a couple of big companies. So for a long time, they've been telling consumers their own story, because why would they tell anybody else's story? So whiskey bonding, which is what I do, was traditionally, back in the glory days that I talked about earlier, it was a huge part of the Irish whiskey industry. And what it means very simply in the context of Irish whiskey is that I do not distill whiskey. I source it from multiple distilleries around the island of Ireland. I build a library of whiskey flavours. I mature that whiskey on my family farm in my own bonded warehouse in my own particular conditions. And then when that whiskey is ready, I blend those whiskies together to create, you know, our own unique house style, essentially. It was, as I said, a very common part of the Irish whiskey industry back in the day. If you drive around Ireland now, you will see pubs in older kind of market towns that still have the term whiskey bonder written over the door, normally in gold letters. And that's a reference to those days. You know, every town in Ireland had two or three whiskey bonders. They were mercantile owners. They were publicans. They just sourced whiskey from one of the many distilleries that would have been around them back in the day. And they put that whiskey into sort of casks they had lying around in their shop, maybe empty cognac casks or empty Bordeaux casks or rum casks or whatever it was. And then they custom blended whiskeys for their customers. So if you were the wealthy merchant family or the landlord family in the town of Kilrush, where my brand is based, you would have gone to J.J. Carey, who was a local whiskey bonder, and you had your own housekeeper's blend. He would make that specifically for you. And then the Glynn family, the wealthy merchant family down the street, would have had their own housekeeper's blend as well. So it was a really bespoke form of sort of making whiskey, certainly, and of consuming whiskey as well. You know, you had something very unique to you that had been very, very carefully blended in a small, small scale by a whiskey bonder.
That's fascinating. It makes me think sort of wine production, maybe vin de pays, where you're not creating this wine, but perhaps buying it and aging it and selling it on that way. But you've actually then revived an old brand, in a sense, because you're using the same name today.
Yes. So when I initially founded the business, I was going to do a grain-to-glass distillery, because that's what you do when you open a craft whiskey company. And that was my original thinking. And we have a farm, so that's, you know, I was going to build a site on the farm and grow my own grain, et cetera, et cetera. But then I discovered the J.J. Carey brand from the 1890s. And I discovered it because there was a guy, an antique dealer locally to me, actually selling J.J. Carey labels from the 1890s on eBay, would you believe? So I went to go see him and I said to him, because the labels were, it said J.J. Carey, carefully bottled and bonded by J.J. Carey, Kilrush, County Clare, which is exactly where I'm from. And I started to kind of ask around locally to get a handle on like oral history as to who the Carey family were, who J.J. was. Then I went to see that antique dealer who was selling the labels, and he took me into a shed. And nobody ever believes me when I tell them this. He took me into a shed into his backyard, and he had all of this paper ephemera from J.J. Carey's shop from the 1890s. Because in 1983, he had been brought in by the people next door to dismantle J.J. Carey's shop, which had remained completely intact and as it was in the 1890s up until 1983. He dismantled the shop and he preserved everything. And he went upstairs into the attic and he found telegrams and receipts and order books and advertisements and all this paper ephemera from the time that J.J. Carey was whiskey bonding in Kilrush. And I started to go through all of that ephemera and I realized, wow, this is a real brand that existed in the 1890s. This was a real guy, J.J. Carey. He was an amazing entrepreneur. You know, he was a whiskey bonder. He invented a bicycle. He did all sorts of stuff. And I thought, forget the distillery. We'll do whatever this guy did. J.J. Carey will become whiskey bonders. And to understand what whiskey bonding was, I then had to go on another voyage of discovery, which took me to the parliamentary archives in the UK. Because Ireland at the time was governed by the Crown when J.J. Carey would have been active. So I had to look into parliamentary archives discussing whiskey bonding in Ireland at that time period. And that took months and months. And then I realized, OK, whiskey bonding was a massive piece and it's a lost piece of heritage for the Irish whiskey industry. And I felt, OK, the Irish whiskey industry is in a period of renaissance officially. You know, we're coming back. There are lots of new players coming on board. We can't have this renaissance without this vital piece of the industry that was completely lost. So that's when I said, forget the grain to glass distillery. We're going to bring back the lost art of Irish whiskey bonding.
So who are you buying from then? Obviously, if you're going to be a bonder, you've got to go out and find the people that are making this stuff. If you're going to age it, bottle it, sell it, market it. So who do you buy from?
So in 2015, I had to go out and raise funds, basically. And I went out and I bought as much mature stock as I could buy. So bearing in mind that it's only in the last year or so that new guys have started to bring out three-year-old whiskey, right? I own 29-year-old whiskey, I own 31-year-old whiskey, I own 16-year-old, I own 11-year-old. You know, I have a span of sort of ages. And the whiskey brokerage industry is, you know, it's an interesting arcane world, quite frankly. Sometimes you buy direct from distilleries, sometimes you buy from brokers kind of in between. You have to kind of hit the road and seek out where the casks are. I was lucky enough in 2015 to buy before the market went really nuts, you know, because whiskey at that in bulk like that in casks is essentially a commodity, and the value goes up and down according to market demand. Market demand has never been anything like it is today, quite frankly. So I bought as much of it as I could of the older stock back in 2015. And that originally would have come from one of those, you know, those three big distilleries that were producing back in the 90s, basically. I buy two kinds of whiskey, mature whiskey that's ready to get blended and go. And then I buy what I call baby whiskey, which is just new make whiskey that comes off of the still clear like vodka. I then put it into my own casks that are specially selected to match its flavor profile. And then we mature that. And you buy that from all of the new distilleries that are popping up around Ireland. You know, there's about 25, 30, nearly 30 in production. Depends on what day of the week it is in terms of the number who are in production. But you go out, you hit the road, you talk to people, you buy from people who will sell to you, and you spend a lot of time building relationships.
That sounds like the fun part of the business where you get to not only do quality control, but to create flavors and profiles. Huge trend in whiskey in recent years to put that in all kinds of barrels from American oak and Bordeaux casks. What kind of barrels are you working with?
Because we're whiskey bonders, or because I don't distill, like it's really our wood program, as it's called, is incredibly important because, you know, I'm not making that whiskey. I'm sourcing it. I then have to ensure that that new make whiskey matches up to whatever cask I'm putting it in. So we go far and wide for casks. JJ Corey back in the day, I know for a fact that he had casks from Medoc. He had casks from Caribbean rum casks. He had sherry casks, and he had all manner of things, basically. I know for a fact that he had those. And he had access to those because he was living in the middle of the British Empire, and there were ships docking in Kilrush all the time, and he was buying those kind of things off of people. So I took a leaf out of his book, and I said, okay, if JJ Corey was alive today and he was looking for casks, he would, you know, he'd look for a wider range of kind of flavor profiles. And I kind of seek out flavors that I love in my cask sourcing. So I went off to Mexico and we got some mezcal tequila casks, for example. We've used those for a number of different cask influence whiskies that we've done. We released the first ever mezcal tequila finished Irish whiskey, something that you're going to be seeing a lot more of moving forward, I think. You know, we have the standardized sort of old world casks, as I would call them, you know, casks from Bordeaux. We're trying to track down casks from exactly the vineyard plot that JJ Corey sourced from in Medoc back in the day. The winery that he purchased from is shut, unfortunately, but there's a new winery that owns that particular plot that he purchased from. We have sherry casks. We have some new oak casks as well from kind of like Eastern Europe as well that we're experimenting with. We have some new oak from the USA. We have a lot of bourbon casks. We're looking at sort of all manner of flavors, basically, in our wood program. We don't really cut anything out. Some stuff doesn't work, by the way. You know, we've had some stuff that hasn't turned out well, some experiments that isn't great, because if you're putting whiskey into casks that have never really been used before, you just don't know how it's going to turn out, quite frankly. So we range far and wide on that. And for me, actually, that's one of the funnest parts of the business is sourcing casks, because spending times around cooperages and in forests, which is very often where you end up, is pretty amazing.
Sounds like you still have a little bit of a life of adventure and world travel as well in growing this. Tell us a little bit about the range as well, because there's a lot of price points here and you have some quite exclusive whiskies that you've brought to market. So what are the types of things that I might be able to see or go out and buy right now?
So our price point starts at about £80, let's say, you know, around about thereabouts at the moment. We know we have a core range that always comes out. We have a blended whiskey called The Gale, which is our first ever whiskey that we did. And what we tend to do is, like, we'll do batches. So we're finished Gale batch one now. It was about 6,500 bottles. And we've done a batch two, which is about 3,500 bottles. And that's kind of our signature house style. It's a big, juicy, fruit-forward, fruit-bomb style of Irish whiskey. You know, it's very definably Irish. When people look for Irish whiskey, those are the flavors that they go for. So that's our standard, and that'll always be on shelf. And then we have a single malt called the Flintlock. Again, we do that in batches, but again, it's a big, big fruit bomb of a complex sort of single malt that you'll always kind of find on shelf. And then we work then with individual customers to create what we call bonders blends in exactly the same way that JJ Corey would have made, you know, individual housekeeper blends for people. We'll go and work with Milroy's of Soho, for example, who are one of the best whiskey bars probably in the world, certainly in the UK. They'll come over to the farm. We'll talk about what flavor profile they're looking for, what exactly, you know, what exactly they're after. We'll pull casks for them. And then we'll blend. We'll spend like 2 or 3 days blending until we have a blend that they're happy with. And then we'll release that in conjunction with a place like Milroy's. Mm. And we've done that with several places now. We've done it with people like Masters of Malt, those kind of whiskey accounts, places where whiskey consumers go to look for recommendation. We'll work closely with those kind of guys to create those little small bonders blends. And then occasionally, you know, we have one particular whiskey called the Banner Blend, which is exclusively and only available in County Clare, where we're from. Like, if you want to buy it, you have to go to County Clare to get it, because that's kind of a means of us celebrating where we're from and also ensuring that we're attracting kind of custom into our local supporters and our local pubs and our local off licenses and things like that. You know, the Chosen, which we've just launched, it's an Ireland's first ever ultra premium whiskey, which we worked on with two amazing Irish design houses. That really caught fire and caught people's attention in Ireland in particular, because it's quite a bold project. And that has really, it's drawn a lot of people to the area, and it's increased their sort of notoriety. And hopefully everybody will be able to capitalize on that moving forward.
You have revived this brand and an old style of selling whiskey and producing whiskey and whiskey bonding. In the experience you've had in the past in the marketing and with these huge brands, how do you tell the story of JJ Quarry? You don't want it to be something stuck in the past, but it sounds like it is a bit modern because you're doing things with mezcal and tequila cask. But how do you marry that world right now?
Yeah, you have to bridge it. So I always say that we're inspired by our sort of heritage, but we look to the future. You know, like, we're not trying to pretend that we're JJ Quarry from 1890. That's not what we're doing. You know, he was a very progressive guy. I feel like he, like I said, he invented a bicycle. He had the first telegram outpost in the town. So he would have been very forward looking and modern thinking. So We draw from our heritage. You know, that's what we do. We draw from that. But we behave in a very modern way. You know, we look beyond our borders to source casks. We look at what's happening out in the world, you know, over as far as Mexico and all over the place, to see what's going on out there. And we create whiskies for the modern whiskey consumer. And we behave in a very modern way. The kind of customers that we work with, our attitude, you know, internally, and our attitude online and how we communicate, we're not pretending to be something that we're not. We're a heritage brand that we've brought back to life, but in a very sort of modern way.
Mm. What's it meant to you to be able to do this on your family's land and go back home with this?
It's amazing. My dad is nearly 80 years old now. You know, he's a farmer. I'm not a farmer, and my brother's not a farmer, even though we grew up on the farm. For me, the future of the farm, quite frankly, is this. It's whiskey bonding. You know, the farm now will stay in the family. I would never have let it go anyway. But this gives it a purpose, and this gives it sort of a destination as well. So it means an enormous amount to me. Like, it's actually been a tremendous opportunity for me to reconnect with my dad and my mom as well, because I've been away for 30 odd years, you know. So that's been frustrating at times, as you can imagine, but fantastic to have them around all the time and really sort of reconnect in a very different way. So it's been fantastic.
Louise, I've taken a lot of your time and this has been totally fascinating, but I'm just curious about what else you might have in the works. You said you chose not to go down the path of doing, doing your own bespoke distilling, not doing the grain to glass thing. Will you do that in the future, or is this model of whiskey bonding something that you can continue to build?
This is our model. You know, I'm very comfortable with this model now. There are so many new distilleries opening up around Ireland that, you know, in 10 years time, let's say, I'm going to have this outstanding library of whiskey flavors to pull from. You know, it's going to take me time, but I'm very excited about that, because there's lots of different styles of whiskey currently being made now regionally. And in 10 years time, those are going to start to come to fruition, and I'll have them to blend with. So I'm set on whiskey bonding. I think it's a business model that works very well for us. You know, we've managed to reputationally be very transparent about what we're doing and very authentic about what we're doing. And, you know, we live the whiskey bonding ethos. You know, we go out and we're sourcing flavors constantly. You know, it's not a marketing piece. It's what we do. It is our business model. Mm. and we're sticking to it.
Louise McGuan, founder of Irish whiskey bonding company J.J. Corey. You can find out more at chapelgatewhiskey.com. That's Irish whiskey, of course, spelled with an E. My thanks to Louise for coming in and to Christy Evans, who mixed and edited this show. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.